And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the West in the most haunted city in the country. And it's National Candy Corn Day. Need to run out and get a bushel or two. Well, it's October 30th. 303rd day of the year. Leap year is the 304th day. 62 days remain until the end of this year. On this date in 637, in the Arab-Byzantine Wars, Antioch surrenders to the Rashidun Caliphate after the Battle of the Iron Bridge. In 758, Guangzhou is sacked by Arab and Persian pirates. You know you're having a bad day when pirates sack your city. 1137, runoff of Apulia defeats Roger II of Sicily at the Battle of Regnano. That secured Randolph's position as Duke until he died 2 years later. I don't care how high you get, death is the great leveler. 1270, the Eighth Crusade ends by an agreement between Charles I of Anjou, who had placed his deceased brother, Louis IX of France, and the Hafsid dynasty of Tunis in Tunisia. 1340, Reconquista. Portuguese and Castilian forces halt a Muslim invasion at the Battle of Rio Salado. 1657, Anglo-Spanish War. Spanish forces fail to retake Jamaica at the Battle of Ocho Rios. 1806, War of the Fourth Coalition. Convinced he is drastically outnumbered, Prussian General von Romberg, who has 5,300 men under his command, surrenders the city of Stettin to 800 French soldiers. And since it was French soldiers, that was nothing short of a miracle. 1817, Simon Bolivar becomes president of the Third Republic of Venezuela. 1831, Nat Turner is arrested for leading the bloodiest slave rebellion in U.S. history. 1863, Danish Prince Wilhelm arrives in Athens to assume his throne as George I, King of the Hellenes. 1864, Treaty of Vienna signed. In that treaty, Denmark relinquishes one province each to Prussia and Austria. 1888, the Rudd concessions granted by Matabeleland to the agents of Cecil Rhodes. Now, for those who are not familiar with the Rudd concession. It was a written concession for exclusive mining rights in Matabeleland, Mashonaland, other adjoining territories in what's today Zimbabwe. It's granted by King Lobagula of the Matabeleland to Charles Rudd, James Roquefort McGuire, and Francis Thompson. 3 agents acting on behalf of the South African-based politician and businessman Cecil Rhodes. Now, despite the king's later attempts to disavow it, it proved the foundation for the royal charter granted by the UK to Rhodes' British South Africa Company in October of 1889. And it also allowed for the British to basically take over. Well, in 1905, Tsar Nicholas II issues the October Manifesto. It granted the Russian people basic civil rights and the right to form a Duma or a Congress. 1918, Ottoman Empire signs the Armistice of Mudros with the Allies. Also in 1918, lands of the Crown of St. Stephen, a state union of the Kingdom of Hungary and the Crown Kingdom of Croatia, Slavonia and Dalmatia, is abolished with decisions made in the Croatian and Hungarian parliaments. 1920, Communist Party of Australia is founded in Sydney. I've never seen what the great attraction is to the Communist Party. 1938, Orson Welles broadcast his radio play, H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds. It caused anxiety in some of the audience in the U.S. In fact, that night, there were people wandering around the countryside with shotguns shooting at water towers that looked just like the alien war machines described in the play. 1941, President Roosevelt approves $1 billion in lend-lease aid to the Allied nations. Had it not been for that, they probably would have lost to Germany. 1941, 1,500 Jews from Bihatsi are sent by the Nazis to Belzec extermination camp. 1942, Lieutenant Tony Fasson and Able Seaman Colin Grazier drown while taking code books from the sinking German submarine U-559. Getting the code books was considered quite a coup, especially the Enigma, which was a machine that allowed them to create literally unbreakable codes, though eventually we did manage to do it. 1944, Anne and Margot Frank are deported from Auschwitz to the Bergen-Belsen concentration camp, where they die from disease the next year, right before the end of World War II. 1945, Jackie Robinson of the Kansas City Monarchs signs a contract with the Brooklyn Dodgers, broke the baseball color line. And frankly, though I was born and raised in the South, I don't see what the big issue is on color. People are people. There are sorry people on both sides of the color barrier. 1947, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, the foundation of the World Trade Organization, is founded. 1948, a Luzu fishing boat overloaded with passengers capsizes and sinks in the Gozo Channel off Kwaya, Gozo, and Malta. There were 27 people on board, 23 died of drowning. 1953, President Eisenhower approves the top secret document NSC 162/2 concerning the maintenance of a strong nuclear deterrent force against the Soviet Union. 1956, Hungarian Revolution, the government recognizes a new workers' council. Army officer Bela Kerali leads an attack on the Communist Party headquarters. 1959, Piedmont Airlines Flight 349 crashes on approach to Charlottesville Albemarle Airport in Albemarle County, Virginia. 27 people on board, 26 died in the crash. 1961, the Soviet Union detonates the Tsar Bomba, the most powerful explosive device ever detonated. 1961, due to violations of Vladimir Lenin's precepts, it's decreed that Joseph Stalin's body be removed from its place of honor inside Lenin's tomb and be buried near the Kremlin wall with a plain granite marker. 1973, the Bosphorus Bridge in Turkey is completed. It connects the continents of Europe and Asia with the Bosphorus for the second time. 1975, Prince Juan Carlos I of Spain becomes acting head of state, takes over for the country's alien dictator, General Francisco Franco. Juan Carlos was a cousin of mine. 1980, El Salvador and Honduras agree to put the border dispute fought over in 1969's football war before the International Court of Justice. 1974, also known as the Soccer War, or the Hundred Hours War, was a brief war fought between El Salvador and Honduras in 1969. Existing tensions between the two countries coincided with the rioting during a 1970 FIFA World Cup qualifier. The war began on July 14, 1969, when the Salvadoran military launched an attack against Honduras. The Organization of American States negotiated a ceasefire on the night of July 18th, took full effect on July 20th. Salvadoran troops are withdrawn in early August. People fight over the strangest things. 1983, the first democratic elections in Argentina after 7 years of military rule are held. 1985, Space Shuttle Challenger lifts off from mission STS-61A, its final successful mission. 1991, Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The Madrid Conference commences in an effort to revive peace negotiations between Israel and Palestine. 1995, Quebec citizens narrowly vote in favor of remaining a province of Canada in their second referendum on national sovereignty. It was 50.58% to 49.42%. It barely passed to remain a province. 2005, the rebuilt Dresden Frauenkirche, destroyed in the firebombing of Dresden during World War II, was reconsecrated after a 13-year rebuilding project. 2014, Sweden is the first European Union member state to officially recognize the state of Palestine. 2015, 64 people are killed, more than 147 injured after a fire in a nightclub in the Romanian capital of Bucharest. Well, there were quite a lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays. Anniversary of the declaration of the Slovak nation in Slovakia. Christian feast day. Ethelnoth the Good, Blessed Dominic Collins in the Catholic Ireland and the Society of Jesus. Gerard of Potenza, Blessed Maria Teresa of St. Joseph, John Wycliffe in the Episcopal Church, Marcellus of Tangier, Saturnius of Cagliari, Serapion of Antioch, Telerikon in Tarkin, Theonistus, Zenobius and Zenobia, Day of Remembrance of the Victims of Political Repression in the Former Soviet Republics, Thevar Jayanti in the Thevar community in India. And let's see what else we have on this particular day in history. It's also known as Devil's Night, Mischief Night. In the year 701, John the Sixth of Greece begins his reign as Catholic Pope. Alberic nominates Pope Marinus II. That was in 942. 1077, the Holy Roman Emperor Henry IV gives the district of Stavoren to the Bishop of Utrecht, who was Conrad, his former tutor, so it was all in the family, so to speak. 1468, Charles the Bold, Duke of Burgundy, occupies and plunders Liege. 1470, the War of the Roses, Henry VI of England returns to the English throne after the Earl of Warwick defeats Yorkist in battle. 1485, Henry VII of England is crowned at Westminster Abbey. 1502, Vasco da Gama returns to Calicut, India for the second time. 1503, Queen Isabella of Spain bans violence against Indians. 1611, Gustav II Adolf, who was 17 years old, becomes the King of Sweden. 1629, King Charles I gives the Bahamas to Sir Robert Heath. 1768, the first Methodist church in North America colonies was initiated on this date. Wesley Chapel in New York City. The 1772, Captain James Cook arrives with the ship Resolution in Cape Town, South Africa. 1784, Napoleon Bonaparte is admitted to the elite École Militaire in Paris, the start of his military career. 'Hannah Montana is founded on this date in 1864. 1866, Jesse James Gang robs a bank in Lexington, Missouri. Got $2,000, which was nothing to sneeze at in 1866. 1868, John Menard of Louisiana is the first African American elected to Congress. 1893, the U.S. Senate approves repealing the Sherman Silver Purchase Act of 1890. 1894, Daniel Cooper patents the time clock. 1899, the Battle of Ladysmith in Natal, South Africa. The Boers defeat the British, which leads to the siege of Ladysmith. And in 1899, the British Morning Post reporter by the name of Winston Churchill reaches Cape Town. 1903, in violation of their promise to evacuate Manchuria, the Russians reoccupy Mukden and reinforce their troops in Manchuria. 2 months Lori Loughlin begins her 2 month prison sentence for her part in the scandal involving admission to college. 1917, the British government gave final approval to the Balfour Declaration, which was written by Prime Minister Arthur Balfour, which gave British support to the creation of what became the State of Israel. 1921, for you film buffs, The Sheik, a silent film starring Rudolph Valentino, premiered in Los Angeles.
Motion detected at the front door.
There's always something going on around here. Always. All right. 1939, Russia and, well, the USSR and Germany agree on the partitioning of Poland. 1939, a German U-boat failed to sink the English battleship Nelson. On board was Winston Churchill, Dudley Pound, and Charles Forbes. 1950, Pope Pius XII witnessed the miracle of the sun while at the Vatican. 1952, Clarence Birdseye sold the first frozen peas. Well, we've been talking about what I refer to as unfinished business, which are unsolved murders. And we're talking about the murder of Mary Fagan. See, she was found dead in the basement of the National Pencil Company. And the person who was eventually found guilty was the superintendent, Leo Frank. And the main evidence against him seems to be the fact he was Jewish. Now, after the body was found, police notified Frank and went to pick him up. And one of the detectives asked Frank if he knew a girl named Mary Fagan, and he said you have to look at the factory payroll.
Motion detected at the front door.
When I got there, he went to his office, pulled out an employee ledger, and confirmed Mary Fagan was or had been employed at the pencil company. At that point, he seemed to remember Mary and said she'd come in to get her pay. Stenographer left at noon, and the office boy had left a few minutes later, and he thought Mary came in about 12:15. He also mentioned somebody who'd been fired, J.M. Gant, had also come in that same day to pick up a pair of shoes he left behind, and he thought that Mary knew him. So the police immediately began searching for J.M. Gant. And certainly throughout his time with the police, as most people would be, Leo Franks acted nervous and nervously talked. And this was later viewed as a sign of guilt by investigators. In fact, N.V. Darley, the general foreman of the plant who Franks had called to come in, said that Franks was actually trembling, which no one seemed to be able to understand. Now, the story of Mary's last day was put together from various witnesses. It was Memorial Day, which was a holiday, so it was the first holiday Mary had been able to enjoy, even though she was now laid off. Every day would be a holiday till she found another job. Now, she'd planned to go get her pay from the factory, which amounted to a big $1.20, which at that point in time was a respectable amount of money. And she's going to spend the rest of the day watching the Confederate veterans parade down Peachtree Street in Atlanta. And according to her mother, Mary had a lunch of cabbages and biscuit before leaving for the factory. She was said to have boarded a streetcar about noon for the trip to the factory. At that point, it should be commented that Mary's attire was described as rather dressy for somebody who was going to a factory and then watching a parade. It was what those in the South used to call Sunday go-to-meeting attire. A lavender dress, white hose, a bow in her hair. I mean, this wasn't casual dress by any means. So the theory was she was planning on meeting a paramour of some sort. But even though this was a possible theory, it was never addressed by the police. Once on the streetcar, Mary met a neighbor boy by the name of George Epps. They sat together on the car, and before she left the car, she promised to meet him at 1 o'clock and go watch the parade with him. Well, they met in Forsyth Streets. She left the streetcar. She was about a block from the factory building at this point, and that was the last anybody admitted seeing Mary Fagan. Now, late that evening, George Epps went to Mary's house to find out why she had met him at the parade, as she had promised. And he found her mother's very worried because Mary had not come home. Jitty Bicombe and her stepfather went into town to check all the places Mary might have gone, but could not find any sign of her. No one he questioned had seen, or at least admitted to having seen, the young girl. It wasn't until early Sunday morning, April 27th, that Helen Ferguson, a neighbor, came to tell Francis Fagan that Mary was dead. Coleman immediately rushed down to the Bloomfield mortuary where he viewed the body, confirming that it was, in fact, Mary Fagan, whose body was at the mortuary. Well, when word spread of Mary's murder, the largest crowds in Atlanta history to that time came to view the body, estimated to be over 20,000 people. Hundreds more came to view the body at the funeral in Marietta. Now, prior to the funeral, physicians made an examination of parts of Mary's body, though their results were kept secret until the trial. On Tuesday, April 29th, Mary Fagan was laid to rest in the old family cemetery in Marietta. But in a shocking turn of events, on May 7th, the body was exhumed at the order of the state solicitor, and detailed examination was made of the stomach and other vital organs by H.F. Harris, a physician from the State Board of Health. Again, the findings from this unusual examination were kept secret until the trial, which took place almost 3 months later. Now, though police were sure they got their man with the arrest of Newt Lee, the night watchman, they were forced to examine some of the hundreds of tips that flooded into their headquarters. In addition to the so-called murder notes that were found in the basement, Lee had been able to tell the officers it was a white girl, and he said he had not examined the body, and according to officers, Mary was so grimy it was impossible to tell what color she was from any distance. Lee claimed that he knew she was white based on her hair. Should also be mentioned in their initial investigation of the crime scene that much of the evidence from there had been compromised by the first officers to arrive on the scene. In the darkness of the basement, police had trampled a trail in the dirt that led from the elevator shaft, along which police believe the killer dragged the body. Footprints that were found around the body were never identified, and the bloody fingerprints on the sliding door were never properly investigated either. The author or authors of what the press were calling the murder notes was never ascertained. There were many, many unanswered questions in regard to this investigation. There are also questions that arose on how police found blood spots on the second floor of the factory around a machine upon which Mary Fagan had worked. And even if they did, what would be the relevance of this blood when she'd been laid off and was no longer operating that machine? What would have been her reason to be around the machine at this point, especially dressed in what were probably her best clothes? Then it was stated that blood spots had also been found on the first floor near the elevator shaft. This supported a theory she'd been murdered and taken to the basement where her body was dumped. Now, a witness came forward who said that he'd seen Mary Fagan at 12:10 p.m. walking along Forsyth Street with a former streetcar conductor named Arthur Mullinax. E.L. Sintel, an employee of the C.J. Kemper Grocery, told police he knew Mary, had known her for years, and that there was no doubt that it was she he had seen with Mullinax. So, based on this unsubstantiated eyewitness account, Mullinax was arrested and thrown in jail on suspicion of murder. Then police arrested J.M. Gant on suspicion. He'd worked at the factory, knew Mary, and didn't have a solid alibi. His sister, Miss C.F. Terrell, said he'd stayed at her house Friday night, but then she gave conflicting statements about his movements after that. So now there were three people arrested in regard to Mary's murder. On Monday, April 28th, the pencil factory hired the local Pinkerton detectives to help the bumbling police solve the crime. That same morning, the coroner, Paul Donahue, convened a coroner's jury in the metal room of the pencil factory for a viewing of the possible murder scene. The jury was adjourned immediately after they had a chance to examine the room. On May 1st, at the coroner's inquest, Mullinax's fiancée, Pearl Robinson, came forward and stated it was she that had been walking with Mullinax on Forsyth Street at 12:10 on that particular day. Faced with this eyewitness account, E.L. Sintel retracted his statement. Mullinax was freed. Gant was freed as well, and it turned out the evidence against him wasn't solid enough for a conviction. Then, as if arresting three wrongly wasn't enough, on Tuesday, April 29th, Leo Frank, the superintendent, was arrested on suspicion of the murder of Mary Fagan. Little did he know, when that cell door slammed shut behind him, he'd never see freedom again. In the Georgia legal system, then as today, accusation equals guilt. The trial was a mere formality, which is unfortunately true today. The evidence against him couldn't be said to be conclusive. Certainly wasn't sufficient for an arrest in any other jurisdiction in the country, but this was the state of Georgia, a place where race and position mattered a great deal. Police felt they had a solid case against the man. By his own admission, Frank was the last man known to have seen Mary Fagan alive. He appeared nervous when Newt Lee came to the factory early in the afternoon. He called Newt Lee on the telephone during the evening, something he had never done before, and he was nervous when Gant came to the factory on Saturday afternoon. And then he was nervous when officers took him to the factory on Sunday morning. Frankly, in a modern court,
motion detected at the front door.
Any first-year legal aid attorney could have destroyed this case, but this was Georgia. And behind the scenes, it was clear it would make a lot of people happy if Franks were convicted. After all, he was Jewish. If they couldn't pin the case on Newt Lee, a black man, then who better than Frank, who was
Jews, a Jewish person. And even though they arrested Raleigh Frank, Atlanta police didn't give up on their chief suspect, Newt Lee. In an effort to find additional evidence, police conducted a detailed search of Lee's home. In a burn barrel in back of his cabin, investigators discovered a shirt with dark stains on it. Investigators, without bothering to go have any tests done, immediately declared it to be blood, and Mary Fagan's blood at that. The blood was smeared high up on the armpits, and the shirt appeared to have never been worn. And while police were initially jubilant over the discovery of the conclusive evidence, as they called it, they began to believe the shirt may have been planted to incriminate Lee. The main problem with this evidence was that police couldn't explain why the shirt appeared not to have been worn after the blood was smeared on it. For his part, Newt Lee denied ever having seen the shirt before, claiming that the one he'd had on he'd worn for a week. So police, without any evidence, finally decided Franks had arranged that the shirt be planted to incriminate Lee. Now, in hindsight, it appears there was no single piece of direct evidence that pointed the blame to Frank. But there are a lot of small things. According to Steve Olney, who wrote a book called And the Dead Shall Rise, The Murder of Mary Fagan and the Lynching of Leo Frank, the evidence against Leo Frank consisted of just the following items. Police had dropped the charges against Mullinax and Gant. The rumors that Mary Fagan had been seen later than 12:15 on the street were discounted, which made Frank the last person to admit to having seen Mary alive when he gave her her paycheck. Frank called in the Pinkertons, and they couldn't figure out how to charge Newt Lee for his role in the matter. Now, police were willing to shift things around and even make things up to make their case. Now they decided that Newt Lee was actually Frank's accomplice in the murder. Authorities arranged a face-to-face meeting between Newt Lee and Leo Frank in the hope that one or the other would make an incriminating statement. Nothing conclusive came from this meeting, but the police viewed it as further factor implicating Frank as the murderer. This is where no evidence is evidence of guilt. During the coroner's inquest, the newspaper boy, Joy Jepp, said that Mary had mentioned to him that Frank had once winked at her and looked suspicious. Now, what does that mean? Well, he didn't see it, so whatever he said was hearsay. There was no evidence submitted supporting these events, and no explanation what Mary allegedly meant when she called him suspicious. And as a matter of law, this statement by Epps was hearsay at its finest, and certainly under the rules of evidence, it wasn't admissible at trial, but in a Georgia courtroom, the rules of evidence really didn't apply. Hearsay is how many cases are decided in Georgia. To make matters worse for Frank, several of the women who worked at the pencil factory said that Frank had flirted with them, and one claimed that she'd been propositioned. Of course, none of these witnesses had anything at all to back up their claims, not even being able to furnish dates on when these events are supposed to have happened. The detectives even had to admit they had so far obtained no conclusive evidence or even had any clues in this baffling mystery. Based on this nothing of a case, the coroner ordered that both Newt Lee and Leo Frank be detained. Now in May, William Burns of the Burns Detective Agency traveled to Atlanta to offer assistance in solving the case. But that same month, his firm withdrew from the case due to the petty politics that have continually interfered with the investigation. The agency quickly became uncomfortable with the many societal implications in the case, one of the most important being that since Frank was a rich Jew, that meant he could buy off the police and bring in private detectives to get him off. There was also said to be an intense animosity between the police and the private detectives hired by the pencil factory. It even resulted in the police following the private detectives to ensure they didn't plant evidence that would clear Frank, because they knew he was guilty. Well, the police left no stone unturned in their efforts to build a case against Leo Frank. They even had Frank strip and allow his body to be examined for wounds of any sort. They didn't find any, but nor did they find any blood on the suit that he wore that day or none on any other clothing at his home. Now, the mere fact that they did this without a warrant today would cause a major problem, but in Georgia, who needs a warrant? In spite of this, it seems that officers were positive Frank was the culprit and left no stone unturned to make the case. Officers questioned Jim Conley, the factory's janitor, and he admitted he lied on several occasions. Based on what he had to say after some coaching, the police used his statements to build the case against Leo Frank. And there are also indications that the third degree, now that's a euphemism for torture. In other words, they inflicted pain, physical or mental, to extract confessions. In 1931, the Wickersham Commission found that the use of the third degree was widespread in the United States, and it was definitely used in this case against some of the witnesses to get them to make the statements the police wanted. As we'll see as we go along, the third degree was used on several potential witnesses to build the case against Leo Frank. Now, one important facet of the prosecution's case was the timeline they worked so hard to establish. However, even the most basic overview showed some problems with that timeline. Based on the stomach contents, the prosecution argued that Mary Fagan died between 12 o'clock and 12:15. One of the prosecutor's main witnesses, Montine Stover, testified she'd gone to Frank's office to get her paycheck. She was positive she waited there from 12:05 to 12:10 and didn't see Frank in his office. According to the prosecution, this proved that Frank was busy killing Mary Fagan at the same time, which is why he was not in his office. Of course, Maureen Stover wasn't asked to prove she'd been in Frank's office or show anything to corroborate how long she'd been in that office or even if she was ever in his office. They took her word. The testimony of George Epps was used to establish what time Mary said they'd gotten off the trolley. He was adamant she'd left the trolley at 12:07, exactly. However, both the motorman, W.M. Matthews, and the conductor, W.T. Hollis, testified that Fagan got off the trolley at 12:10. They also testified that George Epps had not been on the trolley that day. However, the prosecution refused to question Epps' testimony. They needed it to make their timeline work. Well, according to testimony offered at trial, it takes 3 to 4 minutes from the trolley stop to walk to the factory. If the motorman and the conductor were correct regarding the time Mary left the trolley, the earliest she could have arrived at the factory unless she ran from the trolley stop to the factory, which was never inquired into, was about 12:15. By this time, Maureen Stover, by her own testimony, had left Frank's office, which makes her testimony irrelevant. It also shows that the time of death, to be accurate, Mary had to be killed the moment she stepped into the factory, which didn't fit with the prosecution's theory. However, since the authorities were adamant that Frank's killed Mary, adjustments to stories and statements were made. Part of the problem was that members of the coroner's jury, the grand jury, and the trial jury had been bombarded by press reports and police statements that Frank was guilty. So his chances of a fair trial were almost nil, no matter what evidence was submitted. Now, the trial was almost a formality, since testimony that should have cleared Frank was ignored time and time again. Lemmy Quinn, the foreman of the metal room, also testified he spoke to Frank in his office at 12:20. Frank had not mentioned Quinn's visit when he was first interviewed by police on April 27th. At the coroner's inquest, Frank testified that Quinn had arrived less than 10 minutes after Fagan left his office. At trial, Frank testified it was less than 5 minutes after Fagan left that Quinn had arrived. All right. Defense witnesses testified it would have taken at least 30 minutes to murder Fagan, take the body to the basement, get... I tell you, everybody and their dog is calling today trying to sell me stuff. Anyway, defense witnesses testified it would have taken at least a half an hour to murder Fagan, take the body to the basement, get back to his office, and write the so-called murder notes. But Frank's time was fully accounted for between 11:30 and 1:30. The crucial time was between 12 and 12:15, and if you met Quinn at 12:20, and Quinn said Frank was sitting at his desk working when he arrived, Frank was certainly not writing murder notes and showed no signs of having just committed a murder. If the witnesses were telling the truth, Leo Frank certainly could not have killed Mary Fagan. Prosecution dealt with this problem with their timeline and witnesses that tended to career Frank by simply ignoring them. In the case of Quinn, the police accused Quinn of lying, naturally without submitting any proof supporting this charge, and then reminded the jury that Frank had mentioned Quinn in his statements to the police. So according to the prosecution, this proved that Quinn's testimony had to be fraudulent. And race certainly played a part in this trial, and prosecution did nothing to stop it. The prosecution focused a portion of their case on what they call Frank's sexual behavior, which was based entirely on the unsupported testimony of Jim Conley, the plant janitor. Much was also made in the press about the sexual desires of Jews for white Gentile women. According to Albert Lindemann, who wrote a book called The Jew Accused, The Anti-Semitic Affairs, according to Lindemann in his work, there was a developing stereotype of wanting young Jewish males that hungered for fair-haired Gentile women. Now, while this was said to be a familiar stereotype in Europe, this unreasoned fear of Jewish sexuality threatening white Gentile females reached Atlanta in the 1890s with the arrival of a wave of Eastern European Jews. And it might also be noted this same stereotype was very similar to the belief that freed blacks lusted after the flower of Southern beauty. You know, a lot of the evidence against Leo Frank was unreasoned fears in people's minds. Now, this alleged desire for white Gentile women, tacitly supported by the prosecution's case, inflamed those who decided Frank had to be guilty and directly led to the truly disgraceful actions that happened later, which I might add were never punished, which is typical of Georgia justice. As for the racial prejudice part, actually both legal teams, defense as well as prosecution, made use of racial stereotypes during the trial. The defense, who believed that Conley was either the killer or helped kill Mary, pictured Conley as a new kind of African-American, anarchic, degraded, and dangerous. The prosecutor, on the other hand, pictured Conley as a familiar type of Negro, like a minstrel player or a plantation worker. And they also maintained that Conley wasn't intelligent enough to concoct a complicated story, so what he said had to be the truth. Well, as mentioned before, the prosecution based the bulk of its case on the testimony of Jim Conley, the factory janitor. Evidence was found after the trial showing that it was probably Conley that killed Mary Fagan, but having been publicly committed to the guilt of Frank and under tremendous pressure by the demands of the public that the Jewish pervert, as they call him, be hung, the evidence implicating Conley was ignored by the police.
Motion detected at the front door.
Now, Conley was first investigated and arrested when a witness, E.L. Holloway, the plant timekeeper, reported that Conley had been seen washing red stains from a blue work shirt. Conley claimed it was rust stains he was washing out of his shirt since he'd been called to testify at the coroner's inquest and he wouldn't go in front of the coroner's jury with a dirty shirt. Police, of course, without any investigation, saw no reason not to believe in him, but they locked him up anyway because, after all, they had cell space. In his initial statement to police, Conley maintained he had not been anywhere near the factory on the day of the murder. He also told Detective Scott he couldn't write a word when Scott asked him to write a few sentences for comparison with the murder notes. Scott believed him when Conley said he couldn't write, so police just let him sit in jail. It was only after investigators began to get negative reports about Conley from other workers that they turned their attention to him again. It seemed he had a long criminal record and wasn't very well liked at the factory. Also had a reputation for borrowing money and not playing it back. Of course, even this wasn't enough to get investigators to consider him a suspect until Scott found out from a clerk at the factory that Conley could both read and write. He had lied. Now that police knew that his original statement wasn't true, they gave him their full attention and even went so far as to give him the third degree. Finally, on Friday, May 23rd, Conley admitted he knew how to write and gave officers a sample. Quick comparison by individuals not trained in handwriting comparison, I might add, made it clear that Conley had very likely written the murder notes that police had found at the scene. But it wasn't until the next morning that Conley changed his story. It was 10 a.m. on a Saturday morning when Conley sent for Detective Black. When Black arrived at his cell, Conley said he'd lied in his first statement to the police, but now he's going to tell the whole story. He said he had written the so-called murder notes, but it was because Leo Frank had ordered him to do so. Conley said Franks had promised that if he wrote the notes, he'd send them to his mother, and she'd give Conley a job. Conley was elated. He knew that Black was elated. He knew that Conley just put the rope around Frank's neck, and he, Black, would get the credit. First thing he did was test Conley on his spelling and discovered that Conley's spelling of various words in the murder notes was consistent with the original notes. There's no doubt that Conley had written the two murder notes. The main problem from the point of view of the police was that Conley swore that Frank asked him to write the notes on Friday, which suggested premeditation. It also suggested that Frank, who was Conley's boss at the factory, had confessed to Conley about killing the girl, which police didn't believe Conley would, Frank would do. Though police knew that Conley was still lying, if he'd allow them to coach him, the statement would seal the case against Frank. So his second affidavit to the police helped solidify the case against Frank by at least confirming beyond a shadow of a doubt who had written the murder notes. There were still some gaps in Conley's story, and deciding to get the full story out of Conley, the police subject him to the third degree again. Though the defense claimed the police actually took Conley to school to tell him what to say in his third affidavit. Certainly his third attempt at making a formal statement, in spite of some remaining issues, firmly put the noose around Frank's neck. In this third statement, Conley admitted he'd lied about meeting Frank on Friday. The premeditation angle was just simply unbelievable. He also said he met Frank on the street on Saturday. He said Frank told him to follow him to the plant and hide in a wardrobe so that two women who were going to visit Frank wouldn't see him. He further claimed that Frank directed the note, dictated the notes for him to write. He went on to claim that after he wrote his notes, he left the plant and went to a movie. Now, police were concerned that Conley didn't admit he knew a crime had taken place before he wrote the notes, which meant that Frank had dictated the notes arbitrarily. And that caused a problem with the prosecutor's case. Pencil company officials responded that they believed that Conley at that point was at the plant to rob one or more employees. Police disputed this and never followed up, in spite of evidence supporting that belief. Because if they prosecuted their witness, that would ruin the case against Frank. Fagan's purse was never found, but again, police refused to follow up on the possibility that Conley robbed a girl and took the purse since he was an important witness against Frank, who everybody knew was the real killer. Now, the police attempted to arrange a face-to-face meeting between Frank and Conley, but Frank wanted his attorney present, who was out of town, so the meeting didn't take place. The Atlanta Constitution quoted police as saying Frank's refusal to meet without his attorney proved he was guilty. Determined to finalize the case against Frank, on May 29th, police met with Conley for over 4 hours. During this meeting, Conley agreed to prepare a new affidavit. This was the third one where he admitted he previously lied. He now said that Frank told him that he had picked up a girl back there and let her fall and that her head hit against something. Conley now said he and Frank took the body to the basement and on the elevator and then returned to Frank's office where Frank dictated the murder notes. Well, according to this third affidavit and a fourth statement, the two returned to Frank's office where Conley hid in the wardrobe. He also said Frank had given him $200 but took it back, saying, "Let me have that and I'll make it all right with you on Monday if I live and nothing happens." At trial, Conley changed his story again and said that Frank withheld the $200 and Conley had burned the body in the basement. There was a furnace there. The Georgian hired William Manning Smith to represent Conley for the sum of $40. Smith believed Conley had told the truth in his fourth statement, but he was concerned that Conley was giving long jailhouse interviews to the media. Had him moved to another wing, the jail, where nobody could get to him except officers. On February 14th, 1914, Conley was sentenced to a year in jail for being an accomplice after the fact to the murder of Mary Fagan. Frankly, the verdict from the trial was almost a foregone conclusion. The Atlanta Constitution that had broken the story, the Atlanta Journal, and the Atlanta Georgian were competing to see which paper could publish the most lurid details about this murder. Newspaper coverage combined real evidence leaked from police with unsubstantiated rumors and blatant speculation. The public, of course, ate it up. By the time of the trial, there was nobody qualified to sit on a jury who had not been made aware of every single aspect of this case. Naturally, the papers had been daily trying Frank in the press to the point the public called him that Jewish pervert, so how could he get a fair trial? But that was the state of Georgia. That was the state of justice in Georgia, and that is still the state of justice in Georgia. May 23rd, 1914, a grand jury was convened. May 23rd, 1913, a grand jury was convened to hear evidence for an indictment against Leo Frank for the murder of Mary Fagan. Hugh Dorsey, the prosecutor, presented only enough evidence to get the indictment, assuring the jury he had additional evidence would be presented at trial. May 24th, the grand jury returned the requested indictment. Frank's legal team demanded that the grand jury indict Jim Conley, who they sure was the actual killer. The grand jury foreman, on his own authority, convened the jury on July 21st, but Hugh Dorsey convinced the jury not to indict Connally. After all, he was the state's star witness. The trial began July 28 in the Fulton County Superior Court. Leonard S. Roan was the judge. The prosecution team was a little unusual. Hugh Dorsey was the prosecutor, assisted by William Smith, Jim Connally's own attorney. Leo Frank was defended by a team of 8 attorneys. In addition to the hundreds of spectators inside the courtroom, there were thousands gathered outside the building. The tremendous crowd and all the media pressure for a conviction was one of the factors brought out in later appeals as factors in the alleged intimidation of the witnesses and the jury. The prosecution presented witnesses who testified as to the hair and blood stains found on the lathe in the metal room to support their theory the murder took place on the second floor of the factory near Frank's office. Now, from the record, there seemed to be an assumption that the hair and blood found on the lathe belonged to Mary Fagan. But there was never any evidence actually presented that it was her blood and hair. And there was much argument as to whether the murder took place in spite of the testimony as to the blood stains. Certainly the cord tied around her neck could be found anywhere in the factory. The prosecution believed the scene in the basement supported Connally's story. Remember, the assistant prosecutor was Connally's own attorney. A clear conflict of interest that the court ignored. And that the body was carried down in the elevator. The implication was that only Frank had a key to the elevator, but that wasn't true. However, the drag marks, which police hadn't thoroughly investigated, supported the idea the body was taken down the ladder and then dragged across the floor. And then there was the purse that still hadn't been found. Prior to the trial and in his various statements, Connally denied knowing anything about the purse. However, at trial and after careful police coaching, he said he saw Frank put the purse in his office safe. Of course, when the safe was opened on Monday after the murder, there was no sign of the missing purse, but this little faux pas was ignored. After all, they had to get a conviction. And now the sexual aspects of the case came to the forefront. The prosecution alleged that Frank, with Connally's assistant, regularly met with women in his office for sexual relations. Another change in his previous statements, Connally now said he saw Fagan go upstairs and heard a scream shortly after that. He said he dozed off, and when he awoke, Frank called him upstairs and showed him Fagan's body. He said Frank admitted he had hurt Mary, and he reverted to his previous statements about taking the body to the basement. The defense cross-examined Connally for 16 hours, but they couldn't break his story. The defense then moved to have his testimony stricken in its entirety concerning the alleged rendezvous. Judge Roan ruled that had the objection been made earlier, he might have agreed, but since the testimony had been made, it couldn't be unheard by the jury, so he denied the objection. Prosecution then addressed the issue of whether or not Frank expected Mary to come to his office on Saturday. They called Helen Ferguson, the factory worker who first notified Mary's parents about her murder. Ferguson testified she tried to pick up Fagan's pay on Friday from Leo Frank and was told that Fagan had to come pick it up in person. According to the prosecution, this proved Frank had reason to expect Mary to come to his office on Saturday. No one, as far as the record indicates, ever inquired as to how Heron Ferguson found out Mary had been murdered when it seemed nobody else knew. And there were two witnesses, both the person that manned the pay window and the woman standing behind Ferguson in the line at the pay window who disputed her testimony. Both said in accordance with normal practice, Frank did not disperse the pay that day and that it was common practice nobody could pick up somebody else's pay envelope unless prior arrangements had been made. Prosecution, as usual, ignored this particular testimony because it tended to clear Frank. Defense also called a number of factory girls who testified they had never seen Frank flirting with or touching the girls, and they considered him to be a person of good character. In rebuttal, Dorsey called a steady stream of former factory workers and asked the question, "Do you know of Mr. Frank's character for lasciviousness?" The answers were usually negative, but hearsay with no evidence to support it was accepted by the court, as is the way things are done in Georgia. We can't let a little evidence get in the way of a good conviction. There were numerous charges and countercharges between the defense and the prosecution regarding witness tampering, intimidation, and bribery. Defense went so far as to request a mistrial due to their belief the jury had been intimidated by the mass crowd surrounding the courthouse, but as usual, their motion was denied. However, fearing for the safety of Frank and his lawyers in case he's found not guilty, Judge Roan and the defense team agreed that neither Frank nor his attorneys would be present when the verdict was read. Well, after 4 hours of deliberation on August 25th, The jury reached what was said to be a unanimous guilty verdict. He was guilty of murder. It's also interesting to note, even though the jury deliberations are supposed to be secret, the very next morning, Atlanta Journal reported the deliberations took less than 2 hours. The first ballot showed that only one jury was undecided, but within 2 hours, the second ballot was unanimous for guilt. It seemed the news media had a direct pipeline to the jury room. On August 26, 1913, the day after the guilty verdict was read, Judge Rome brought counsel into his private chambers and sentenced Leo Frank to death by hanging. Set the date on October 10th. Defense team immediately issued a public protest claiming that public opinion and news media unconsciously influenced the jury against Frank. Now, at this point in time, under Georgia law, as it's laughingly called, appeals of death penalty cases had to be based on errors of law, not a reevaluation of the evidence. The appeals process had to begin with a reconsideration by the trial judge. The defense presented a written appeal alleging 115 procedural errors. On October 31st, 1913, Judge Rohn denied the motion, stating while he wasn't thoroughly convinced that Frank was guilty or innocent. He didn't have to be convinced. The jury did have to be convinced, and it was clear that they were. Next step in the appeals process was a hearing before the Georgia Supreme Court. In addition to raising the previous arguments, the defense also focused on Judge Rowan's previous reservations. They also cited six cases where a new trial has been granted after the trial judge expressed misgivings about the jury verdict. Prosecution countered with arguments that the evidence convicting Franks was substantial. This substantial evidence was primarily Connolly's coach for affidavits. And that listing the judge's doubts in the defense's bill of exception was not the proper way to present the evidence. On February 7, 1914, in a 142-page decision, the Georgia Supreme Court denied Frank a new trial. However, the dissenting justices restricted their opinion to Connolly's testimony, which they declared should not have been allowed to stand. They concluded the evidence prejudiced Frank in the jury's eyes, denied him a fair trial. In spite of this, on March 7, 1914, Frank's execution was set for April 17, 1914. In spite of these losses, the defense didn't give up. Based on their discoveries, they filed an extraordinary motion with the state Supreme Court. This resulted in a stay of execution, and the hearing on this extraordinary motion opened on April 23, 1914. The defense had amassed a mountain of new evidence to call the verdict into question. A number of witnesses wrote affidavits that repudiated their testimony. A state biologist ran tests on the hair found on the lathe and stated in a newspaper interview the hair was not that of Mary Fagan. This newly amassed evidence was leaked to the media, and as a result, the state began to seek repudiations of the repudiations. An analysis of the murder note showed it had probably been written in the basement and not in Frank's office, as stated by Connolly in his testimony. And there was one other issue regarding the police investigation that was revisited at this point in the appeals process. During the initial investigation, undisturbed human excrement was found in the bottom of the elevator shaft. When questioned, Connolly admitted he'd left it there before the murder. On Monday after the murder, when authorities used the elevator, it crushed the excrement. This meant that if Frank and Connolly used the elevator on Saturday to transport the bodies claimed by Connolly, it would have crushed it, but it was undisturbed when the police found it after the murder. Dorsey responded, this proved nothing as the elevator didn't always go all the way to the bottom. It could be stopped anywhere. However, Connolly himself had stated it always went to the bottom. During a request to Governor Slayton, an attorney and his firm had merged with that of Frank's defense counsel. So many felt Slayton was biased, but nobody cared at this point. The governor conducted his own test and discovered the elevator always went to the bottom of the shaft, and thus Connolly lied about he and Frank transporting the body to the basement. Also discovered the notes were written on dated order pads that had been signed by a previous employee, and they were only kept in the basement. So the notes had not been written in Frank's office, as Connolly claimed. We're going to stop right there. There's a whole lot more to this case that we'll talk about in our next show. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great weekend.